Welcome to On Publishing from the Binary Agency. This is Alex Field.
And this is Ingrid Beck. Every week, we talk to professionals from the world of publishing. Our goal is to educate, inspire, encourage, and inform.
Let's get started.
On today's episode of On Publishing, we talk with Don Pape, publisher at Nav Press, a faith-based publisher in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Nav Press is best known as the publisher of the Message Bible and is the publishing arm of the Navigators ministry here in Colorado. Don has been in publishing for at least 32 years and has held a variety of roles. He got his start in publishing as a warehouse worker, picking and packing book orders. He did graphic design for a while. He was in marketing and sales and also was a literary agent as well. So Don has just a really unique perspective on publishing, having held so many different jobs and seen how publishing has evolved over the last 30 or so years. So this is just a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, Don is a friend of ours, and we've known him for many years, and I never knew he worked in the book warehouse, picking and packing and shipping books. I never knew he was a graphic design guy either. What I did know about Don, and what I think you'll hear in this conversation, is that he is, was, and has been, since I've known him, has always been passionate about books. He is a reader. And sometimes in this business, you get people who, and this isn't bad, this is just what it is, but you get people who come up and they love the business side of this, or they love the marketing side of publishing. Don has always been one who is moved by the power of words, who loves great books and great writing. And I've traded many a book recommendation with him over the years. So I think that comes through in this discussion.
Absolutely. I think the other thing about Don is he is a passionate advocate for authors, no matter the job he's had. He cares for them. I mean, and really is a champion for them and for their books. And so, you know, if you're an author who is curious about what it's like to get a book published, I think Don has a unique perspective also on what it requires of an author to continue to promote their book after it's been published, and all of those aspects of publishing that maybe, you know, we don't think about as much.
Yeah. And now that he's been a publisher for many years, I'm not sure of the actual number of years he's been serving as sort of an executive in the publisher's chair. He does share a lot of that perspective as well, leading a faith-based imprint, as you said. How does he lead a team? One, how does he publish well? And especially in the changing marketplace and landscape that we're all in, how do you do that? What does it look like to be a publisher? But then he also tells these wonderful stories of the people he's worked with. I think he even talks about Madeline L'Engle, who is someone that we all love and that he published several books with at one point in his journey. So this is a fun one for any of you who want to hear about some of that from the publisher's perspective and get a sense really on the inside what it's like to sit in that chair. Well, I hope you enjoy this interview. Before we get to that, if you are in the middle of writing something and you're looking for more resources or more information, please check out our website, www.thebinaryagency.com. We do have a bunch of articles up there, some on the business of publishing, some on the editorial side of publishing. And by the way, also, if you have questions for us that you'd like us to talk about on this podcast, send us an email. info@thebinaryagency.com is our email address. Put the word podcast in your subject line and we'll get to it as quickly as we can. And maybe we'll address some of your questions here on the air. If you have subjects, people you'd like us to interview, include them as well. All right, Don Pape, welcome to On Publishing. Don is an old friend of ours and a legend in book publishing. He has been on the sales side of the business. He's been a literary agent. He's been a publisher at several different companies and has had massive success as well. So Don, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome. Hey, it's good to be here.
On this podcast, we talk publishing. We're book nerds. We read a ton, and all things publishing are fascinating to us, and we hope that's the same for our listeners. So awesome. We're just going to dive right in.
All right, Don, so tell us how long you've been in publishing, And as Alex mentioned, you've been in several different roles. So give us, if you missed anything, give us some highlights of the different roles you've played. And then maybe tell us a little bit about how you got into the industry.
So this year would probably be 32, 33 years in publishing. Don't remember Gutenberg, but it's been a while. And some fun days. I actually started by working in the warehouse. I was in Toronto on InterVarsity staff.
Okay.
And they had IVP warehouse in Toronto, in North Toronto. I would go up there and make extra money, pick, pack, and ship books. Got the bug there. And then when I left InterVarsity, I actually got into graphic design. And this is way back before Macs. And I would do ads for the newspaper, work in a dark room, develop them, and put them on a big Kodak yellow box, put them on a bus, send them down to the Toronto Star, and they would print it. So I came in that way, graphic design, doing posters, all that kind of stuff. Got hired actually by David C. Cook Canada to be their corporate marketing guy. Worked for them for some years, and then had my own company, Canadian Signature Group. That's actually how I connected with Waterbrook then. I was doing their marketing for Canada. Did that for Cumberland House, Waterbrook Press, and Howard Books when they were an independent family operation out of West Monroe. Yeah, so keep going on the timeline. Goodness, another 25 years then. So then fast forward, I worked, had my own company, as I said. I worked freelance for Doubleday Books, and that's when they started Waterbrook. And so I actually came down here as a consultant.
Doing marketing?
Actually, or with sales.
Okay.
Worked with Doug Gabbert, who was VP of sales for Waterbrook at the time.
Okay.
Moved here and rented a house because we thought we'd be here for 9 months. That was 20 years ago. Did that kind of as a sales consultant in the sales department with Doug, and then Waterbrook acquired Harold Shaw Publishers, a small family-owned company in Chicago, and I was appointed publisher of that imprint of Waterbrook at the time. Probably one of the funnest parts of that job was getting to work with Madeline L'Engle,
Many
of you know from Wrinkle in Time, but we got to do The Rock That Is Higher, Walking on Water, some of her just amazing books.
Yeah,
so we acquired Harold Shaw, and I was then went from that to publisher of Waterbrook for a number of years, and then left there for a little foray into literary agencing, 19 months specifically.
19.
It was a fun job. I love publishing more than I like literary agency, in that I just really, and Alex, you can appreciate that, I wanted the team thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what I love about publishing in general, not unlike here, is just sitting around with people brainstorming, mm-hmm. those kind of things. Yeah. So left there to go to David C. Cook to work with Dan Rich, who I'd worked with at Waterbrook. And he called me up. I remember the call. I've got a job description with your name on it. Why don't you come on over? Did that for a while, and actually that's where we wooed Alex to move from California, and was there for, 8-9 years before I went to where I'm currently at Nat Press. Yeah, so I have to retire because I've run out of publishing.
It's good. You've done a lot of cool books and worked with a lot of cool authors in that time. While we're on that, tell us a little bit about Nav Press, what you do now, your role. Just for those who don't know anything about it, the kind of books you publish, things like
that. Sure. So Nav Press is probably best known as the publisher of the Message Bible.
Yep.
But then it's also the publishing arm of a Christian ministry based in Colorado Springs called the Navigators. That's actually worldwide. And in 2013, they entered into an alliance with Tyndale House Publishers out of Carroll Stream, Illinois, in that Tyndale handles all this back-end stuff. So the typesetting, proofreading, sales, marketing, warehousing, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. Our office here in the Springs is essentially the editorial offices. We acquire books, edit them, and then send them up to Tyndale House. And I've been there 5 years now. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to pivot a tiny bit because I'm curious about this. You ran your own company for a few years. You worked in sales before jumping over to the publishing side. How is that different? The sales side of this business, obviously, there's some very similar things. You're pitching books to buyers, to bookstores, to distributors. If you could talk a tiny bit about that side of the business, what does that look like?
Well, I always say we're all in sales, right? Whether you're in sales or editorial, you know, frankly, marketing and design are sales because they're pitching, you know, when we meet for design kickoffs, they're pitching their designs and hopefully one of them is going to be a strong cover. So we're all engaged in sales. As far as retail sales, we have, I mean, over the 30 years that I've been involved in publishing, Christian publishing in particular, it's so changed, right? I mean, when I got started, I worked for a chain, Provident Bookstores, and I was actually a music buyer. So in somewhere in my timeline there between doing graphic designs, I was a music buyer for Provident Bookstores based out of Pennsylvania. So they had a store in London, Ontario, and one in Waterloo. So I was the buyer for the university store in Waterloo. And that was fun. All that to say, it was part of, you know, the big Christian Booksellers Association. You go to their annual events that would attract 15, 16,000 people. And that really was the only venue that you had to get our books into was through Christian Book and Bible or your local Christian bookstore, right?
Right.
Now, you know, you have it online, you can buy it at the grocery store, the pharmacy, Walgreens, what have you. There's so many options now. And essentially today, I would argue that the Christian Booksellers Association has disappeared. I mean, there are some independent moms and pops out there and some marketing groups. But in terms of a robust association, it's just gone away. So, and I think that really reflects the demographics, too, that... we were, you know, we were talking about my mom before we started this, that consumer that was so faithful to come into that specifically Christian retail store has really disappeared, right? I mean, my mom would go in, buy her Dayspring cards, her Warner Press napkins, her, you know, Sunday school curriculum, and then her Jeanette Oak Amish fiction kind of thing. Now, I think we're much more comfortable buying online or going to Barnes & Noble, buying my Fast Company alongside of my J.D. Greer, whomever.
That's right.
So the consumer has changed. And I also think that the loyalty of the consumer is a challenge for sales. Mm-hmm. You know, when you used to sell a book, you had a loyalty to the publishing house.
Yeah.
And you had a consumer who, you know, the next time you bring out a Jerry Bridges, I'm going to be there. All 20,000 of us. Doesn't exist that more anyway. So.
Yeah, that's true. It has changed a lot in that sense. And Amazon, obviously, is the 800-pound gorilla in the room with all of that. It's changed everything.
Right, right. And the gatekeepers have gone, too. You know, there was a time where I can recall going into a bookstore selling John Trent and a bookstore saying, oh, I'm not going to carry John Trent. He's a psychologist. Or, you know, you'd walk in and they wouldn't carry Chuck Colson because he was dilly-dallying with Catholics. And so... that element of the market has gone away. And so you don't have that problem in sales.
So there's some positives and negatives here.
Right, right. Yeah. Now you have the flip side. You have general market that are going to be opposed to Christian publishers because of some of our content or maybe our stand on marriage or what have you. And so they'll censor our product. But it's all good. People still buy books.
That's the good news.
Yeah.
So you spoke to a few of the changes that have happened in publishing throughout your time in the industry. What shifts do you think have impacted authors most?
I think it's a challenge for authors in that I believe, this is a true statement, I think publishers put too much onus on the authors now to hustle their books. Mm-hmm. And some authors are really good at that. You know, they come to the table with a Facebook page of 28,000 people, they have a mailing list, blah, blah, blah.
Or they're just naturally gifted in the ability.
Right, they're extroverts, they can command a crowd when they walk into a room, all that kind of stuff. There are other authors that couldn't. You know, I jokingly say, you know, if C.S. Lewis or Bonhoeffer, you know, dare I say Eugene Peterson, some of these folk were starting out today, they wouldn't have had a chance.
Yeah.
Maybe sold 981 copies of a book, but that's about it. So I think that's a real tension.
And I think it's still, or in the same ways that it's harder to you can't go to one place and sell books in.
Exactly.
Authors can't go to one place and find their audience. It's right. a much more kind of scattershot approach in trying to.
Back in the day, you'd take an author, say, to a CBA convention or a book expo convention, get them in front of thousands of retailers and know, oh, good, when we ship their book, we're shipping 35,000 copies right. of the book. Now there's so much competition. You know, CBA essentially doesn't exist. Book Expo, you know, is trying to find more consumers. So they're doing Book Expo and Book Con. Yeah, there's just more challenges.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions we get all the time from people submitting queries or manuscripts, novels, nonfiction, all sorts of different categories, is why does a book stand out to you? What makes you get excited about a project? And obviously, well, there are as many ways to choose books as there are people, in other words. So what are the things that make you and your team want to pick up and acquire a book, sign an author to a contract?
Yeah. At Nav Press, we're somewhat of a boutique in that we're doing 15, 18 max in a year. So we are very, very selective. And I think it's the question we had way back when, Alex, that we'd say, you know, is this a magazine article?
Yeah.
Right.
Or is it a book?
Yep.
It very quickly kind of disqualifies the project. At the end of the day, it's just, is it really good writing? Is it fresh material? You know, Ecclesiastes was right. There's nothing new under the sun, but there are new voices. And, you know, I think that's when I look at my career, that's what I love about my career in publishing is being able to launch new voices. Two authors that come to mind, well, not two authors, I won't name them because then I'll get in trouble for not naming the other ones, right? So, but there are a number of authors that come to mind that have written some amazing books on topics, quite frankly, that have already been written about. But it's just their voice and their take on and perspective on things that you go, I've never heard it that way.
Which is pretty impressive as someone who's been in the industry for so long to still be finding messages that are fresh and unique. That's exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I just looked at a project this morning that a couple sent to us, and it's on marriage. Mm-hmm. And goodness, how many marriage books are out there? But the way they're presenting it, mm-hmm. the way they have written it together as a couple, their approach, their just even their attitude, it was just very fresh. And you go, oh, this would be a fun project to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes it's just a really personal connection with a message or with an author too, right?
Absolutely. I mean, years ago, Steve Rubin told me, he was a publisher at Doubleday. He said, you know, you got to understand the business of publishing is blind ass luck. You know, and it is.
Yeah.
There's no guarantee. You look at a book and you think, this is really good. And then you go, how in the world did that not hit the bestseller list? Mm-hmm. And how did that one hit the bestseller yeah. list?
Right.
You know? The yeah. girl that's got water in her face or in her hair or wherever the heck she's got water.
It's always a girl.
Yeah.
It's always a girl in a dream.
Yeah. 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 Somebody's wife.
Yeah. The phrase I've heard thrown around is this is the only form of legalized gambling.
Exactly. Exactly. And you have to, what is it? 8 out of 10 books don't make it?
Correct.
Yeah.
So you're going in like, it is blind ass luck. And sometimes you see success and sometimes you don't, but it doesn't. The one thing I always say to the author is your success and the quality of your work does not rely on the New York Times list.
Ooh, and that's good.
Maybe you only find, 1,000, 1,200 people to read your book, but it still is a good book.
And it's still worth the effort.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think that would surprise a lot of writers or first-time authors who are writing their book or they're getting ready to pitch it to publishers to hear you say, and we've talked about this a lot, that this is a risk every single time you go out with a book to the marketplace. So what is the role you play in that as a publisher? And I know there's a lot that goes into that whole process, but in terms of kind of figuring out where to take a risk, I mean, what is important about that role that you've really curated over the last, 30 years of your career?
Yeah. Well, there's a number of roles you have. One is with editorial being a checks and balances. As you know, editors can get really orgasmic about little words. And it's like, that doesn't make it a good book.
Yeah, that's right.
So it starts there. And then you have to be a champion with sales and marketing And at the end of the day, the publisher is really the champion of his authors, mm-hmm. of his list. And so, you know, so I really feel strongly that's my role, is to represent the author well. And it is a risk. So in terms of my financial backers, if you will, my boss, I have to say, you know, this is why we chose these books. These are the books we want to do. This is our projections for the next 2 years or what have you, based on the retail conditions. And, you know, like we've already said, there's no guarantee.
Right.
We just hope and think and risk and invest. And hopefully the investments are good ones. My real role is to be an author champion. Yeah. And it's probably the best. Like, I do not really love financials.
Yeah.
P&Ls, all those fun things you have to deal with, month ends and ugh. But God bless them, that's part of the business, right?
Yeah.
So it needs to exist. What I love and why I keep doing it is the author relations. Working with them, with wordsmiths, being their champion, advocate, what have you.
Yeah, and you may be the best in the industry at that. Honestly, you have a way with authors. You encourage people like nobody I've ever seen. So for those
out
there,
it's not hard to do, you know. It's
tell us about it. Yeah, how do you do it?
I mean, I was saying to someone the other day, they were saying, "Oh, you're so good at blah blah blah," and I go, "You know, it's not hard to do. It's picking up the phone when it's someone's birthday and you know it. I think it would be really easy just to put it on Facebook because I think that's our default.
Sure.
But what would a 2-minute phone call be?
Yeah.
Or dropping a note, writing a note. Postage still exists in this country, so we can.
For now.
Yeah. 50 cents a stamp. Can you believe it? Oh. But, you know, it really doesn't take much. And it's that just showing you care. And honestly, I think it's also a love factor. I love my authors. Mm-hmm. And I would say in my career, I haven't loved all of them. And those of you who are wondering, you know who you are. But I'm just kidding. I love them all. But I think that's really important. And as I've said to my editors, life is too short to work with authors that are, you know, just frustrating. You want to have a good relationship. It's not going to be all bed of roses.
Yeah.
But you really want to love that relationship.
Well, and it seems like you do. In order to really pull the best out of them, it needs to be, you need to have some relational collateral. You need to be able to nurture them and in order to kind of pull out their gift.
Right.
And
the trust factor, right? Yeah. I mean, if I'm going to critique their baby, their writing, there has to be a relationship there. Otherwise I really don't have the role or the position to speak into their work.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we're talking about publisher. We could talk about some of the other things you've done. What would you say to those who want to break into the publishing industry? We're not talking about authors now, but somebody who might want to be an editor or do what you're doing right now, and they're 20 years old and in college and studying English or sales or who knows what, marketing. But they see the role of a publisher at a bookhouse as being a goal. Like, that's what they want to do. So somebody like that, or somebody who's in the industry and maybe early on, what sort of advice would you give them, kind of seeing what you're seeing in the industry right now?
Keep your job at Chick-fil-A. No, it's going to sound ethereal, but you have to feel called to what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're working at a fiction house in New York or an educational publisher in Chicago, wherever you are, you have to really feel committed to that, because this is not a get rich quick industry, right? So you just have to be in it for the long haul. And if you're coming in as an editor, you want to learn the ropes and be willing to learn. I think that's key. Ask a lot of questions. Go to Festival of Faith in Writing or writers groups or what have you. Read Writer's Digest or pick up PW, Publishers Weekly. But if someone wants to get into a career where they're going to make a ton of money and retire at 40, this is not the industry.
Choose another path.
Exactly. Yes. But it's an incredible, it's a rich industry. I mean, creatively, the people you meet, the conversations you have, the stimulation. I mean, you don't have to agree with everybody. It's just learning, you know, that's what I love.
Yeah. Awesome. That's great advice. I love that. Well, and that's what we've done, I think, in our own varied paths. So,
yeah.
So you've led a lot of teams in your career. What have you learned about leadership specifically within the publishing setting?
This is why I love Alex, because he and I share the quality of being rogue publishing leaders. I don't like ties. I don't like blazers. I don't like wearing socks. I don't golf. So there's a lot of things that don't qualify me for big houses. What I love about the industry and what I've learned as a leader is that someone's got to lead, but it's really important to know how to lead in a team setting, allowing other people to contribute to your qualities as a leader. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think of, you know, this is interesting because I've worked with both of you as a leader, with you leading, having roles as leaders, and knowing your strengths and weaknesses and your capacity to bring to the table what I needed that I couldn't have, that I didn't have. So, like, you were organizationally genius and could handle Firebrand and a bunch of other stuff to get schedules done. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do that, but I needed a publishing colleague that could handle that. Mm-hmm. You know, Alex was good at doing those deep dives into the backlist and patiently cultivating stuff. So, and you know, you'd look at, I'm not going to name all our team, but you'd look at each of those people and what they brought to the table. I knew I was leading, but I knew I was leading with the strength of all those people at the table, knowing that they were going to come through for me.
Right.
I had their back, they had my back, and that was really important.
Yeah, so just part of it is just putting together or utilizing the team that you have, putting together a great team.
I mean, I look back on all, even now it's a much smaller team, but it's a dream team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you say dream team, what you mean by that is you had the right people on the bus, so to speak, that knew what they had to do to get the books out the door.
And you really enjoy working with them, too.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun.
That's incredibly important, though. What you just described, the knowing where you need people, requires a level of self-awareness where you go, okay, I may not be as strong in this area, so I need somebody here or whatever. And that can be a humbling thing to kind of look at yourself and then look at your team and find out where the gaps are. And but that's massive for leadership.
It gets better with age, right? I'm 60 now, so there's a lot. I mean, when I was in 26 and in my 30s, I did some stupid stuff.
Yeah.
When I look back on some leadership, even some hires that I look back, ooh, how did I hire them? And part of it was I didn't know myself, never mind the individuals at the table. So you're right. It's important to know my deficiencies, and you learn that with maturity, I think, or age.
It's good.
Age or maturity, whichever, whichever comes first.
Yeah.
When's that hopefully they in? Come together, but they don't always. So taking a little bit of a diversion here, you mentioned retirement. If you think about where publishing is going, do you have any ideas of changes that might be in store down the road?
Like in the industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, boy, it's such an interesting question because I'm reading a lot about this next generation. You know, we're past millennials now and into Z. So there's mixed messages I'm hearing. I'm hearing about parents who are giving their kids, you know, their iPads and, you know, these baby Beethoven babe kids that are growing up very familiar with an iPad and an iPhone and the screen, you know, that.
So digitally savvy.
Exactly. Yeah. But then you also hear the flip of what the deficiencies are to a child's brain or an adult brain by all the screen time we're investing. So I'm really encouraged that books are going to live, that people want to curate books. So that encourages me. It's the retail landscape that I don't know. How will people, you know, it's that word everyone uses that I hate, but it's called discoverability.
Yeah.
You know, they throw that around. And that is a true challenge, is there's such a large amount of books being published, probably a greater amount of books published today than there ever was. Mm-hmm. But then how do I find out about it? If I don't have a bookstore to walk into, mm-hmm. and I'm just at the risk of my women fancy on ChristianBooks.com or Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, that's a challenge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you don't know, in other words, how.
That's exactly right. I'm not going to look into my crystal ball.
You had some amazing.
Well, I think the good news is people keep buying books. Good news is what format are they going to buy the books? Like, mm-hmm. are we going to go? You know, I can remember when we were told all the books are going to be digital.
Right.
Yeah, that's
back
not
in the day. And that we haven't seen that. How are we going to buy books? Are we going to buy them online more? Mm-hmm. I am a big proponent of independent booksellers. So I love Tattered Cover and Book Bar in Denver mm-hmm. and other independents. And I love supporting them so that we do have places for people to go and discover books.
There's still something about that experience of walking into a bookstore that people love still. And the ones who are really doing that really well, cultivating that really great experience.
Yeah. And I think there is an element of parents, too, that see the sacredness of a book, mm-hmm. that it's an artifact, if you will, and want to introduce their children at a young age to a book. There's all the techies out there. But I think there's a group of parents that want children at an early age to recognize this is a book. It can take you places you'll never go elsewhere. Right. And so that encourages me. Yeah.
Me too. I mean, I think it encourages all of us in this industry. This is books are going to be around for a long, long time. Of the publishing of books, there will be no end. So you worked as an agent on the dark side of the industry, which we do now.
You're one of them.
We're on the dark side here.
No.
So while you played on that side of the industry, what did you learn about what it takes to make a good book? And in that role, you kind of see a bunch of different publishers, you meet all the editors, you get a sense of different styles and priorities. So yeah, what did you learn on that side of the industry that helps you now as a publisher that can help those who might want to be an agent?
I always joked that I was a Jewish grandmother, like I was a matchmaker, right? So I was not always looking just for the deal, but to connect the author with the right house. And, you know, oftentimes what that meant is I was putting an author at a house that wasn't going to offer as much money as somebody else, but it was just this editor is going to do a much better job on this project than the editor over here. Mm-hmm. And just the takeaway for me was always, and still is, I was always astounded by, okay, so I've got this project here that's worth $10,000. And another equally good project over here that's worth six figures. Like, what gives? Yeah. Like, it's just so odd.
Yeah.
Discovered, you'd go in with a book proposal and you think, oh, man, if I get $12,000 for this, this would be great. And then you get, what? They offered $250,000? Holy frick. So, like, who knew, right?
Yeah,
Right. There's just no kind of... I don't know what the word is, economy of scale or, you know, if you gave a...
Market decides.
Very interesting. So that was a quandary. During my time at the agency, it was just fun to get a proposal and identify, okay, I think these three editors are really going to like this proposal. And I feel good about that match.
That's good. It's a fun part of the process. I enjoy that every day. And like you said, you don't always know where something's going to connect. And you might think this editor's going to be perfect. And then somebody else surprises you.
Right.
And jumps on a book. And it becomes a wonderful connection. And the surprise of that is really fun, too.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it's very fun.
I have found that relationships are so critical in the development of my career. So, and I'm assuming you probably found the same to be true, but how do you cultivate relationships? And especially in an industry that's on the small side, how do you avoid burning bridges when you make moves, transitions in your career?
I think what brings us together, for me relationally, what brings us together is a love of publishing.
Yeah.
And reading.
Right.
So I think of people who I keep in touch with. We have a great relationship, but I also know, for example, I'll get a good book and I'll pop it in the mail to John Blaze, mm-hmm. for example. We may not have coffee for 6-7 months, but there's a relationship there based on we love good books,
right.
good reading. And, you know, I think your point is well taken. How you don't burn bridges is by just keeping in touch.
Yeah.
And, you know, I look at you. You moved to Chicago. When we went to Chicago, we looked you up. Mm-hmm. And it takes effort. So I think publishing is no different than anything else in life.
We have a phrase that we like to say that around the bindery, that one book can change everything, and that can be change everything in your life or your career or relationships or in other ways. Can you think of a book, and it could have been a book you read in the last year or a book you read when you were five, just a book that made a massive impact on you and sort of changed things for you or shot you in a new direction?
Yeah, so years ago, I mean, I hate when people say, what's your favorite book? Because it's like, okay, well, this hour.
Right.
Exactly.
But years ago, actually, my grandmother gave me a book by Sheldon Vonnegut called A Severe Mercy. It was an incredible book, but it was so beautifully written. Mm-hmm. That I just thought, wow, that's really good mm-hmm. literature. Mm-hmm. And so I've just liked reading really good literature. And then more recently, I've just read All Shall Be Well by Catherine McNeil. Mm. And it's just a really beautifully written book about essentially living through the seasons of life. Mm. You know, I could go on and kind of go through my backlist and catalog of books I've been involved in. But I just recently read a new novel by a debut novelist, Kara Wall.
Okay, that's on my list.
Such a good book. I don't know what the question was, but what I'm going to say is I just love discovering really good books and then saying, hey, I found this. Maybe you should read it.
Yeah.
You know, and enjoy it. So
it seems like that, like you said a little bit ago, that excitement about a book or about writing is so much of what fuels the people who are in publishing.
Right. It's energizing.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, have you read? And then you go into the story and then you commiserate about it, and it's life-giving.
Awesome. Don, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. It's always good to talk with you. We always love getting lunch or going to the bookstore together.
Or receiving books in the mail.
Or receiving books
or
in the mail.
Or drinking Loyal Coffee.
Yeah.
Two locations now in Colorado Springs.
Anytime.
Tyler, you are going to be invoiced.
That's right. Thanks again, Don. Appreciate
yes,
it.
Yes, thank
pleasure.
You. Thanks for listening to today's episode of On Publishing. If you loved what you heard, don't forget to subscribe and post a review.
This episode was edited by Joey Howell, and the music was provided by Not the King. And remember, until next time, one book can change everything.